I didn't want to look like we've got this vacant seat sitting there.
We are.
Well, we didn't want the public to
Where is it?
Refused
to have me that close.
I don't care. Interesting. Today is May 23rd, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is an informational hearing on the update on the Medicaid redeterminations. Before we begin, Ms. Ames, is there anything for the committee?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, today OHA is here to update us on the long journey to stand up their eligibility system after the failure of the Oracle system. And then catch up on redeterminations.
And I've already kind of personally talked with everybody in the committee, but the idea the presenters is that we're going to allow you to get through the entire slide presentation and then hold our questions till the end.
Great. Thank you. Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, we're pleased to be here today. And we've made the slide deck as tight as we can so we can go through it adroitly and then have time for your questions and concerns. I'm Lynn Saxton. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority. And Ms. Ames is correct. We are in the last mile of a marathon that we've been running for several years. You've all been watching us run this race. And frankly, Oregonians are worn out with this. It's time to cross the finish line. It's time to move on and have a fully functioning operating Medicaid eligibility system. And we're on track for doing that. Our plan has been to complete the work that we committed to do, which is currently stands at 733,000 Oregonians are receiving Medicaid services in the new eligibility system. And we have a 10% remainder cleanup group of clients that we'll talk to you about this morning that we need to resolve, and we have a plan to do that. It's important to note that this 115,000-plus population was included in our forecast, our spring forecast. Secondly, I'm very pleased today to talk to you about our action plan for resolving these 115,000 cases by August 31st. And with that, let's get started.
Next slide after you did that one pretty much.
First, a few key facts about our Oregon Health Plan. We serve over more than a million Oregonians, one in four state residents. 90% of these members are in coordinated care organizations, and the health system transformation in Oregon, which began in 1994, has produced $1.3 billion in savings to the state since 2013. 4 in 10 adults on the Medicaid program in Oregon under 65 are currently employed. And the economic impact of this Medicaid expansion on our state has been $2.75 billion in federal funding for Oregon. Medicaid, as you know, is a federal-state partnership. There is the traditional population where the state pays about 36% of the cost and the federal government pays 64%. That's what is often referred to as the traditional population. And then there's the expansion population created under the Affordable Care Act. The state has a 6% share here, and in the 17-19 biennium, the federal share is 94%. CMS is our principal funder and investor. The federal government pays more than 90% of the cost for our new eligibility system, and we have recurring documentation of CMS approval of Oregon's eligibility renewal plans. We have shared decision-making for policy and operations. There are weekly calls between our teams to ensure we are on track. That would include our Medicaid director and project managers and project leads. We have regular communication. We'll be talking again to CMS about this project and others this week. And we submit significant quarterly financial reports to CMS. They're about 700 pages long, which show projected expenditures and actual expenditures. This is a map of where we are with Medicaid eligibility in the state today. I want to call your attention to the success story in the middle of the page, which is the over 700,000 Oregonians currently receiving benefits from our new eligibility system. And also highlights the work left to do, which will be completed by August 31st this year. And that's the box at the bottom that says 83,757 people. I want to talk to you a little bit about who those people are. We've had a lot of questions about who are those people and what has been the complexity and the challenge in getting those people enrolled successfully. We refer to these as our cleanup cases, and they are a challenging challenging client profile. The first category are those who are excluded due to a protected eligibility, pregnant women, children under the age of one. The second is non-responders who are connected to an eligible case. The third is where presumptive eligibility exists, but they have not yet been included in the new eligibility system. This is our breast and cervical cancer program participants and extended medical hospital and hospital presumption. Fourth is the eligible but stuck in an old legacy system. The legacy systems are the systems we relied on prior to the new eligibility system, and we've included some nice documentation of that in the appendices to this deck. I'm happy to talk about that in detail. And finally, are those that are applications that are started in one but were not able to be finished. And this is primarily a technological problem and requires further processing by our team. So who are these cleanup cases? About 42% of them are children. You can see the gender distinction. It's important to note that about 58% of these are non-ACA, non-expansion members. Recall that this group of 115,000 plus people were all eligible at Medicaid at some point, so it's not a surprise to us that the majority of them are not expansion population clients or members. And finally, about 86% or more are in CCOs. 14% are on open card, which is also fee-for-service. The geographic distribution in the state is provided here for your reference. We had a lot of questions about that. I won't read you the map, but this is the breakdown. And again, what we anticipate for eligibility going forward is based on historic trends and based on all the work that goes into our spring forecast, is that 72% of this population will be eligible, 28% we anticipate to be ineligible. We've had a lot of discussion about enrollment and what that trend line looks like. I think this is an important graph for you to see, and it shows the orange dots are the actuals since the spring forecast. So this is the orange dots reflect where we're currently moving. Probably about a year ago, our CFO said, I think we're going to land around between 900,000 and a million, and that's what it's looking like. That reflects a great deal of rigor in assessing Medicaid eligibility. We are mindful every day that on the one hand, we need to be sure that people who are eligible for Medicaid have access to Medicaid. At the same time, we are very mindful of the 6% funded on the ACA population by Oregon and what that means to Oregon taxpayers. So we take this work very seriously in ensuring that we are getting it right and doing it accurately. Now, I think it's important, many of you who have been with us on this journey know that we have, on May 31st, caught up our backlog, and we began the analysis of these cases, and we will have a deliverable on August 31st of those cases and their status. That action plan, which is graphed for you below, will be a private partnership. We have several private partners who have helped us along the way keep up and stay on track. Those same partners will be joining us in this implementing this action plan, and we look forward to, as I know everyone in Oregon looks forward to, reaching the finish line, crossing it, and having a successful Medicaid system. I do want to just remind folks that Medicaid, unlike Medicare and Social Security, is a dynamic system. Often people go on and off Medicaid. Particularly the expansion population is designed to be available to people who may be having transitions in their lives. So it is a dynamic system, not a one-time and the rest of your life kind of system. Everyone has to renew in Medicaid every year. So with that, we have a robust appendices for you, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Okay. Questions?
I have a couple.
Yeah, Representative Hayden.
So I'm limited to two. I understand.
Well, if there's a lot of questions, we'll do two follow-ups, okay. And then we'll cycle back through, and you can have the rest of your follow-ups.
I'll start with two questions. The first one is, my understanding, and correct me if I'm incorrect, my understanding is that the waivers from 2013 to 2016 were applied for and approved. The obvious question to me is, why wasn't a waiver from 2016-2017 requested, or was it, or what happened with that process, knowing that our action plan is not going to be complete until 2017. So the question, why the gap in the waiver? Second question, to get my two questions out, given the caseload flexibility and the action plan not being complete until August 31st, I would ask that OHA provide us on the provider tax or the provider assessment a one-year budget so that we could determine what that budget might be and have the opportunity to make reconciliation to that budget prior to having a full budget for the full biennium that could be over or underfunded. Is that possible?
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hayden. Chair Rayfield, the first question. Why is there a gap in the waiver? First, I want to underscore that we have had consistent and clear communications with CMS throughout this process on a weekly basis, and we do have written approval for operating the system in the manner we have since the waiver in 2016. So we're good to go with CMS. So I think that's been one of the issues that's been out there. People have been concerned about. I think our operating discussion with them throughout the first year of the new eligibility system filled in that gap. They've been kept apprised every step of the way, and we had their verbal and written authority to proceed. So that's okay. One. And two, the proposal to provide a one-year budget for the provider tax, we'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
That's
Thank
doable.
You. Thank you. Well, and I have a quick, before we continue, would you walk us through the appendix, please? Because I think
sure.
Those slides are actually
yes.
Pretty good.
Okay.
Do you want me to do that? Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm the Director of External Relations for the Oregon Health Authority. We left these slides in the appendix because we thought they were helpful, but not necessary, but that they might cloud the key information we wanted you to have. So I'll just walk you quickly through it. We have a system launch timeline that talks about the odyssey, if you will, that we've all been on since the failure of Cover Oregon and the steps that the agency has taken along the way. This slide, there's a couple of key pieces that are important. In 2014, we had an enrollment surge through ACA expansion where we had to, at the same time as we were experiencing a change in a problem with our eligibility system, we had to add 400,000 new members. In December 2015, we had to build a brand new eligibility system. When we purchased that system, we knew that there would be 9 enhancement phases necessary to get the system where we need to be. At this point in time, Oregon has completed 5 of those 9 known enhancement phases. In 2016, we launched our new eligibility system, and in March of 2016, we were online and ready to go. We began the process of a very difficult data cleanup phase. We asked all current health plan members to complete a 32-page written application, and then we inputted the thing into the new system. It was a very laborious project, a one-time project, but now we have clean data in our new system, and going forward basis, it's a very easy system for Oregon Health Plan members to be able to go online, check their information. We can verify it electronically, and it's much smoother on a going forward basis. But this was what we needed to do to ensure clean data. We completed our first cycle of renewals in March of 2017, and now we're going through the final analyses of the final 10% of the cases that Lynn described earlier. And we're in the process of planning a IEME eligibility system, a joint project with DHS, to further streamline our eligibility processing for our Oregon Health Plan members. We also have a slide here that just describes the Medicaid eligibility process. We thought this was an important for all of you to at least understand how it works. We use a lot of different terms as we talk about this. Eligibility is based on a 12-month renewal cycle. So every Oregon Health Plan member, on a going forward basis, they have an anniversary date where we go through a renewal process. We re-verify income, household, and residency status, and we were on an application period that's about 80 to 100,000 people per month. When we send our renewal notification, a member would have 45 days to respond back and provide the requested information. In this case, the written application is what this window really applied to. If we don't hear back from them, then we send out a 10-day notice of termination, and then that gives them an additional window to show that they're eligible. And we've processed more than 1.2 million renewals since February 2016. There's also a term that we throw around, redetermination. Redeterminations are self-reported, and Oregon Health Plan members have a responsibility to report changes in their household, changes in their income, changes in their residency. And we go through about an average of 6,200 case closures due to redeterminations every month. We also thought it might be helpful to just sort of see, we talk a lot about the application process over this last year. And the good news is that we're almost at the end of that cycle, and hopefully that will be a problem that we can find new problems to talk about instead of this one. But we wanted to give you a sense of what the application process looks like, and so that's what this page is about. And then we have our OHP eligibility timeline with a lot of the information that just some of the key moments of communication that we've had over the last since June 2013. This is the place where we wanted to show you all the times that we have shared information both with the legislature and with stakeholders. We have a Medicaid advisory committee that is required by federal law to advise the Oregon Health Authority about the health services offered through Medicaid. And then we also had monthly stakeholder meetings where we shared our progress on enrollment and eligibility and our backlog since we did the startup of the new one system. And then we had a number of meetings regarding our audit with the Secretary of State. These are the key dates since January of 2016. And we just wanted to give you a sense of we've been working on this for a while and in good communication. And then this is the slide that kind of shows you where we started. The column on the left are the key eligibility systems used to enroll members to confirm enrollment into the Oregon Health Plan. They move into the system called the MMIS, which is for enrollment and distribution. I'm sorry, the legacy systems are used to confirm eligibility, and we have a number of legacy systems for eligibility. Those feed into the MMIS system used to enroll members and then distribute benefits, and that's how this process works. One is, it's the third box down. But you can see all the different systems that we have to figure out a way to bring together. And that's it. That's our appendices, and we're happy to answer questions about those as we go along.
All right, thank you. Representative Alonso Leon.
Thank you for this information. This is actually a kind of a good reminder for me. So I remember earlier in the session when you guys presented and I think shared a hard copy of the actual application, the 36 pages. That, or 32, thank you. Either way.
It's long.
Either
yes.
way.
Yes.
It's a long, laborious application. And that has taken, I'm sure, a lot of people power, right?
Yes.
To manually sit down with folks and fill it out. And I can imagine the folks in our community who are bilingual or, you know, monolingual, having an interpreter go through that application, that would take even extra more time to fill out the application. So now that we have the one system, I'm assuming that we still have interpreters walking people through the application process. Is that correct?
Yes. Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, yes, we do. We have community assisters across the state. However, I want to underscore that as one matures as a system, it's 1 year old, but as it matures and these additional builds are made, the system is designed to have greater language access capacity than the predecessor systems, whether it was Cover Oregon or other predecessor systems. And I think there is obviously a goal to improve the complexity of the form, to make it tighter and perform better. I think those are the process improvements that are on our dashboard today. And again, in implementing this technology, you have to take it a step at a time. I would just recall for all of us, part of the reason that we stood it up in the manner we did is we were complying with the timeline for the Oracle lawsuit settlement. So it was stood up quickly in 1 year time. 2015 was the build. 2016, one began to work. But we now have process improvements to make, and we'll do so. And they have been planned and will be executed.
Thank you. Can I ask my second question?
Please.
So I really appreciate the timeline as well. So having Cover Oregon, I guess, drop the ball, to say the least, in transition to manually go doing the application process with folks, did we hire additional staff to accommodate the fact that we no longer have an online system to help with the 32-page applications?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, yes. Managing, there are three parts to an IT implementation of this scale, and one is the people and the processes and the technology. And so our goal is to consistently manage all those three variables for success. And again, we have throughout the year, as we've cleared one hurdle, again, calling your attention to the 733,000 members plus that we've gotten through in the last year, we have arranged those resources in varying ways to get the job done. And when we anticipated that we would have this population at the end of the process, we also anticipated that we would have a follow-up close effort, if you will, to complete the work. And that's the work we began May 31st. The action plan that I referenced.
Follow up.
Please.
Thank you. And the reason I asked that question is because I've worked for the state. I have experience. And I know that now that I'm a legislator, I have two lenses in which I see things through now. There's the lens where, as a legislator, we have a responsibility to supporting all of our agencies to make sure that, you know, that work is getting done. And then from a state employee perspective, I've been on that side where I didn't think legislators quite understood our work when, you know, when we requested additional staffing and it was denied. This is general. But yet, legislators kept asking us to do work. So now that I'm on this side, I try to be very mindful of that, making sure that as we continue to provide support to our agencies, that we're also keeping in mind, do we have the capacity to add on additional work to our agencies? Mm-hmm. If we expect you to do extra work on top of what you're already doing, are we also providing you the resources to get it done? So that's really important to me.
Thank you.
And I'm new. So I'm learning from, you know, trying to bring my experience as a state employee, as a legislator, but equally trying to make sure that that when I have conversations with state agencies, that I give them the opportunity to tell me, you know, in order for us to do this additional work, we'll need extra staff, or we need to not be able to do this other work so we can accomplish goals. Yes.
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, thank you, Representative. We are accountable at the Oregon Health Authority every day to the legislature, the governor, and most importantly to the people of Oregon, including the Medicaid members and the taxpayers of Oregon. Throughout this one-year process of implementing our new eligibility system, we have consistently relied on private partners, and those would include KPMG, Deloitte, Shavs, and PH Tech, and a company called Galt. We have relied on our team, who's at the Eligibility Center every day, and we've relied on the agency to keep sharp focus on getting this done and getting it done right as fast as possible. And so we keep that in mind every day. We have multiple accountabilities. We take it very seriously. And I think there is absolutely, we can all understand this has been very long and hard. It's very understandable to me that people are frustrated at this point hearing about it. And so that's why we're going to wrap it up. And that was our plan. It has been our plan. We think we have a good plan to do this work. We're already in the 115,000 yesterday. We're already 6,200 people into that. And all of those people were determined to be eligible as a result of the processing of their complex applications. So we're hard at it every day.
Thank you.
Senator Gilzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask a follow-up to that before I do my two questions?
Please, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
And everybody's really focused on the three questions. So what I want to do is make sure that everybody gets an equal opportunity. So three follow-ups, and then we'll put you back in the queue, and everybody will get to answer all of your ask all of the right. questions. It's just I want to be equal as we approach this. Thank you.
Thank you. So just the follow-up to the representative. I mean, this is an extraordinary amount of work. Where has the, I mean, if you look at kind of the resources needed to fix Cover Oregon, temporary staff, FTE, the purchase of hardware and software, phone lines, computer infrastructure, have you been able to do that within the existing budget? I mean, have you had to compromise other work to get that done? Have we given you the resources to do this extraordinary amount of work? I guess to follow up on.
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, the answer is yes. We have the resources to do this work. We have had to add people at certain times. We've had to come to you and say we need to do this and more and less of that. We need to allocate the resources differently. We have been, I think, successful in bringing all the partners, private and public, to the table throughout the process and saying, here's where we are today, and what do we need to do it better and more cost-effectively. I would give as an example of that the fact that DHS and OHA came together a couple months ago and said, when we started this journey, we thought that most of the expansion population would be people who were not DHS, involved in other DHS programs. So there was a separate eligibility process at OHA and a separate one at DHS, and we were able to come together. Now that we know the business better, we understand the needs better. And so we said, if we're looking at doing this more cost-effectively and in a more accountable way, wouldn't it be better to consolidate our efforts and get it done that way, which helps us start the work for the integrated eligibility project? So at every step of the way, we come together and make tough decisions. Now, one of the things the health authority has been preparing for since August, a year ago, is we're preparing for reductions in our budget. The system is tightening. The healthcare system across the country is tightening. And so our leadership has been involved for months now preparing reprioritization of our work so that we can live within our means, so that we can reduce our cost footprint. We will be very clear. I want to underscore that technology is something that and the processes and the people take a lot of careful planning, execution, but it isn't a linear path. You find bumps in the road. And so we will be clear and we will come forward. If we need additional resources, we will be completely transparent about that. But I want to underscore that we are working very hard to respect the needs of Oregonians, both taxpayers and people on the Medicaid system, to operate a very tight ship.
And then, thank you. So, and I'll just put the two questions together. It's more a comment and a question. When I read the news last week, there was a very splashy news story. And to read it, it would seem that before that report was released, nobody had known that this 115,000 people had existed. But from your presentation, it appears this has been an ongoing conversation that we've had many, many conversations about, for which you had a significant work plan, and that these aren't people that just walked in the door ineligible for services, but are in fact people that have at some point been determined eligible for services, and in this transition of technology you're moving over. So I guess the first question will be, was this really shocking? Are these people you didn't know about? And then the second part is, if you just moved to take all these people off, what's the consequence, both the human consequence and the agency and legal consequence, if you just remove people from Medicaid and you had the majority of them who it turned out they were actually eligible later? What would happen to Oregon and what would happen to those women and children?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, to the first question, I think in our presentation, did we know these people existed? Yes, because they're in the spring forecast. So yes, we did know they existed. I think there is general anxiety about healthcare across the landscape right now, and I'm very pleased to have this opportunity today to get everyone clear about the good work we're doing. So that's the answer to the first question. The second question is, what would happen if we took everyone off? And I want to go back to the information we have in the slides. First of all, taking people off Medicaid who are eligible is illegal. So that's first. Second is, we absolutely believe that people who are ineligible for Medicaid should not be getting Medicaid, right? So we have implemented and had planned to do so. We're not able to do so until now because we had to get through one full renewal cycle with the new eligibility system, but both fraud assessment and risk assessment. So we have two professional firms that work has been on our dashboard for over a year, and that's being executed now. The question particularly about this population, these complex cases, one of the things I would go back to in our slides is the fact that 58% of the 115,000 people are traditional Medicaid people. Now, I've worked with the traditional Medicaid population for over a decade, and these are often people with chronic and severe disabilities. So obviously, removing those people from Medicaid in some sort of wholesale, you know, rush to the finish line would be inappropriate and was, I don't think, is anyone's intention. No one intends to do that. So I think the important thing is, we have to do this job well every day, and we take it really seriously, and the process has been a marathon, and people are worn out. let's finish it up. Let's get it right. Let's move forward. And we need to be as rigorous on the ineligible side as we are on the eligible side. We need to have passions in both sides of the equation to do this job responsibly for the people of Oregon, and that's our goal and that's our intent.
And Mr. Chair, just quickly, I didn't hear you say that of these 115,000 people, at some point they were each found eligible, correct? These are not people that somehow snuck on that nobody ever knew was receiving Medicaid services.
Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, that's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. I want to get back to the actual reason for that we're here, and that's to explain the redetermination process. And looking at the redetermination process, what percentage of that process has corrections been made? And in those, because there is a financial link between that and the CCOs, and how do you manage that particular piece?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, again, just for all of our benefit, redeterminations are when members contact us with information that they are no longer eligible for Medicaid. And so right now, on average, we're at about 6,200 a month. That's varying as one's completely implemented. So in terms of those redeterminations, we work with the CCOs. Obviously, if someone's ineligible, our data systems connect that through the MMIS payment system. There are a number of tiers of accountability to make sure that that data is accurately represented across the system.
Can you break out for us, and I'm looking at now the population that are part of that 115,000, and you've got pregnant women, children, and those populations, and I'm sure that pregnant women don't stay pregnant for...
sometimes.
I'm not going to comment on that. But it would be helpful, and you don't have to do it today, to start breaking those down as to how many, so you get a real feel of what the universe is.
Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, of course. We will do that and get it to you.
Sorry.
Okay. Representative Malmstrom.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair. You stated that, you know, after this time has gone by last year, that you understand the needs better. One of the things that we've mentioned before was this horrendous application process, the 30-plus page thing. What have you done or do you plan to do to make that simpler and easier to use, so you don't have so many people out in limbo because it was incomplete?
Chair Rayfield, Representative Malmstrom. So two things. One, in the build-outs of the four remaining components to our new eligibility system, the processing of that information and having to ask it gets smoother. So let me give you a concrete example of that. One of the assets of the new eligibility system is it takes members and it connects them electronically to the IRS and federal databases that help determine eligibility, right? So we can check status on some of those requirements of the 30, and we do currently check all that status. In the goal at, I remember the meeting, we discussed it, the goal in, this would have been in mid-2015, to get that application to a more manageable length. We wanted to do it then, but in order to get one stood up, operable by the deadline, the decision was made that we could not reformat the software to do that and hit the deadline. So those are some of the decisions that we made and had to make, and now we can make improvements to those decisions as we go. I do want to underscore the importance of under-promising and over-delivering with regard to the capacity of technology to solve all problems. It is complicated. It is expensive. Change orders are expensive. They take a lot of person power and business process analysis. And so our our inclination for the last 2 years has to err on the side of caution and meeting key federal and state guidelines before just assuming lots of changes can be made. We're moving cautiously because the risk of not doing so is, of course, a risk to the members. It's also a financial risk that we want to be very conscious of.
Okay. Follow up?
Please.
Could you give a breakdown or maybe send us a memo later? What percentage of people are applying, you know, at an office versus online versus, you know, there's various ways that you can apply. I'm curious to know how that breaks out.
Chair Rayfield, Representative Malmstrom, yes, we can do that. The applicant portal went live to members in October of last year. We're very appreciative of how well that launch went. That's we expect a portion of the population to do that, but also to our work with DHS over the last few months, we expect people to apply basically through the applicant portal, through calling in, which is a laborious process. The applicant portal is preferable, and then finally through DHS offices.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
All right, Representative Nose.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield. Thanks for having me here this morning. I'm a little bit of a remedial in that the Healthcare Committee had a presentation about this topic back in December, and it was hard to understand, and it was complicated, and I want to commend the agency for this presentation. It makes it a lot clearer what's going on and what's been happening. So I understand it a lot better in a way that it didn't back in December. That's the only comment I want to make since Senator Gelser actually asked my two questions.
All right. Yes, sir.
I've got to complete my three questions.
Oh, yeah, no, well, we're coming back through. I haven't had an opportunity to ask any questions,
Senator.
Well,
that's Senator. Through the chair.
Well, that's yeah.
I'll give you the gavel. So the one question I want to follow up from a budgeting standpoint, you've been talking about adding this into the forecast, right? And so when we make our budgeting this and we're looking for the next 2 years, and I noticed that there's 25% of these folks are actually that will potentially be determined ineligible. We're still verifying that. But that is already factored into the forecast, so we make the right budgeting decisions now.
Chair Rayfield, correct.
Okay. And then the other question, you know, and so there's all these big public headlines talking about, you know, well, we could be wasting millions of dollars right now. What have you guys looked at the total exposure? Are those claims, you know, accurate, inaccurate?
Chair Rayfield, I think the, again, two things. One, those and I haven't seen all the media coverage. I've seen a fair amount of it. But I think that may have been based on the assumption that we did not have approval from the federal government for this, and we do. So that's number one. Number two is our expectation is that at the end of May, when we can look at the analysis and also with the help of KPMG, who we contracted with to help us assess that risk, we'll be able to give you a number. Our in-house analysis so far is that it's not a real risk at this time. We have approval from CMS. We meet with them weekly. And if there is risk from those ineligible people, it's quite possible that, again, I want to go back to Medicaid is not Medicare or Social Security. It is a dynamic system. Every month, there are people kind of coming on, moving off, eligible, not eligible. So that was factored in. We looked at this in preparing that spring forecast, and that was factored in at that time. Now, with that being said, we will immediately inform everyone if there is a concern, but I don't have a concern at this time.
Okay, and with respect to, you know, the actual audit alert talked about, you know, it was like tens of millions of dollars every month or something along those lines that are being potentially being wasted. And I guess really looking at the accuracy of that claim, or is there other exposure in terms of, you know, is it because we're factoring this in the forecast, is that exposure non-existent? I mean, help me understand whether, you know, from inside the agency, whether that's true or not true.
So, Chair Rayfield, I think the assumptions in those alerts do not reflect, first of all, the data we know about the 115,000. There were some broad assumptions made, capitation rates, what percentage of the population was expansion versus non-expansion. We track all those indices consistently, regularly, all the time. And part of what was on our schedule once we did the catch-up on May 31st was this intense action plan from May to August to finally ground all those numbers. As we show in our presentation, currently we think 72% of the people are eligible, and the ineligibility factor is factored into the forecast already. The possibility of some being ineligible.
Okay, so I'm just asking for a direct answer to my question in terms of...
Sorry.
Yeah, in terms of the numbers that are in, that we're potentially wasting a lot of money right now versus the way that you're estimating and looking forward, are these... Is there a reason that we should be concerned about the exposure going forward that we may be wasting money?
Chair Rayfield, no.
Okay, thank you. All right, so we'll cycle back through the committee, and I apologize. I was just trying to, I like your direct answers. So, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield. So just following up on that quickly, and I have one question with a couple of parts here. Secretary of State did provide you, or OHA, with 9 questions. Has OHA fully responded to those questions?
Yes. Chair Rayfield, Representative Hayden, yes.
Thank you. Getting back to the eligibility, and we've talked about the FedEx that package that gets sent out with an oversized mark on it. My concern is that a lot of these clients don't have stable housing. They don't have a home. They may be homeless. It may be very, very difficult to track down, even for FedEx, which is really good at tracking people down. What I'm trying to understand is when that packet doesn't get returned. You know, I think there was an example of 14,000 that hadn't been returned or you weren't able to verify. It doesn't mean they're ineligible. It just means it hasn't been returned. What is the time frame on that? I mean, is that like 60 days and you give up and they're, you know, out of the system? Or how does that process work? And the other thing that I think is an important question to ask, of the 733,000 people that have been verified and I understand eligible through the Deloitte system, is that based on Social Security or is there other parameters, Social Security number, or how do you verify that?
So let's take the first question first, and Beth Ann's going to respond to that.
Chair Rayfield, Representative Hayden, members of the committee. The answer for how this goes is we send out a renewal letter. The member has 45 days to respond back to us. If we don't get a response back in that 45-day window, we send a 10-day termination notice where it sort of says, okay, last chance, and we tell them the date that they will that their benefits will cease, which is usually at the end of the following month. And then at that point, then they can be terminated. If they respond back within that 10 days, then we begin a process to confirm eligibility.
So follow up to that. So I'm assuming a higher rate of people without home security become ineligible because they never receive the packet. Is that a fair statement?
Chair Rayfield, Representative Hayden, members of the committee. That is a fair statement. I also would like to just point out that we have a built-in safety net. So if a person becomes ineligible and then they go in and they need services, they can reapply and they will be retroactively made eligible for the period of time that they qualify for.
And follow up to that, and then my last question you can answer, does DHS use the same 32-page application, or do they have a different process for eligibility for SNAP? And
it's a different process.
Different form.
We're trying to fix that, though.
Easier? And then my last.
Just to introduce yourself first.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Leslie Clement, and I'm the Director of Health Policy and Analytics. The applications are designed specifically to be different because they collect information in terms of a person's level of care. So a lot of the programs that DHS administer are the home and community-based waivers. And they are based on, an individual is eligible for their programs to get the home and community-based services if they meet the level of care of a nursing home, if they meet the level of care of an institution. It's just designed that way. So there's it's more complex, right? It's not just about income status. It's also about, you know, their own health status. It's taken into account. So it requires an assessment that goes through a person's ability to perform activities of daily living. So unless you want to go deeper, that they will never be the same. They're not the same population.
Did you want to go deeper?
How long does the process take? Thank you.
My understanding is they're subject to the same federal Medicaid requirements in terms of turnaround times. They're more challenged to meet those because it often takes a home visit to determine that level of care. So it may be a 90-day. I'm not sure about that.
Is it cleaner? Do you have 115?
I don't know. My guess is, this is how, I've administered, so before I came to OHA, I was a state Medicaid director in Idaho. And in Idaho, I had all these populations directly reporting to me, so all the home and community-based services. I can tell you that the eligibility systems for those disabled populations are far more complex and challenging because they have that additional assessment piece. So cleaner? No, it takes a nurse assessment to determine who's eligible. It's extremely difficult. And I see some shaking heads so that I know that some people may be familiar with this population.
Well, I think my point is maybe we have a lot of this information already in another system, and maybe we could be tapping into that.
Yes, that's exactly.
So, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, of course, we're going to be talking about integrated eligibility on Thursday this week, but that'll be part of that conversation. And you had a second question.
The second one was, do you use Social Security number, or what is the process for eligibility? Is it, like in the business community, we use E-Verify, does Deloitte do that for you, or how does that process work?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, there are, of course, federal standards for what we need to ask for Medicaid eligibility, and that includes a variety of sources of information, and then there's state standards, and including Social Security, but also we'd be happy to send you the application. It's fascinating to me, for example, the first time I filled out an application online as a test before we stood up one, I wanted to see how hard it was and what the data was. It asked me, one of the questions was, do you know your CCO? And I thought, at that point, how many people know their CCO off the top of their head? It's a difficult application. But we will refine it and improve it as we improve our technology capacity.
The question is, on the Social Security, how is it verified? Not that you ask it, but how is it verified?
Right. So let me ask Vivian if it's verified electronically yet. Let me see.
Come on up. Okay. Introduce yourself.
Please state your name for the record.
Yes, of course. I'm Vivian Levy. And to answer your question, Representative Hayden, when we have a Social Security number, we use that information to verify with all the available federal and state electronic sources. When we do not have a Social Security number, such as for an individual who's eligible for emergency Medicaid, we actually request that they provide that verification to us in a paper format, whether that's income verification information or verification of legal status. So regardless of the level of information that we're provided up front, we still have a consistent amount of verification that we require before determining somebody eligible or allowing them to continue with benefits.
and we'll come back. We'll be back around.
At least more questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Senator Winters.
Thank you. I want to go back to a comment, a statement that you made about your work with CMS and that you had continued dialogue all along with CMS. And the question that was made, was asked, was about exposure and whether or not there was possible risk. And I think your comment was that no, that. But I want to, in your conversation with CMS and the letters that you received from CMS, does any of those letters specifically say, state, that regardless of what we do in this process of getting people redetermined, that we are not at any risk whatsoever of having to repay any dollars for because we did not get the work completed?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, the phrasing that you suggest, I think, no. However, that would, I have not seen phrasing like that from CMS. I think part of what is,
let me restate it.
Okay.
What permission did CMS give you? And I raise that because it was in the headlines, and the presumption was about exposure. And I'm trying to just basically clarify. And the comment was that we've had dialogue and conversation and communication back and forth with CMS. So what permission did CMS give us?
Permission in writing, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, to proceed with the process we have been underway for a year in. So they gave us permission in writing in addition to verbal permission. And again, there's a weekly meeting with CMS, with their team and our team. CMS, as you can imagine, CMS funds the eligibility system. They have a huge interest in whether we're using that eligibility system to minimize their risk and to ensure that eligibility is accurately done. So this is a constant communication with them and will continue to be.
So actually we don't have any written communication, and I see that.
Just to be clear, I just want to say this one more time, Chair and members of the committee. We do have written communication from CMS authorizing our eligibility processing in the manner in which we've discussed it today.
I wanted that clarity because there's been a lot of conversation about exposure and the possible exposure of up to, you know, millions of dollars. And so for the record, I would just like to make certain, and if CMS is listening, probably they are not, but if they are, you know, to make certain that we're not. And the other piece of that is in the redetermination and how much of that, those dollars get shifted between the CCOs, which ultimately they're the ones that are providing the service.
Okay. Chair Rayfield, could I just ask you to say the last part of that question again? I was getting
well in the process of doing redetermination, because this is fluid from what I'm hearing you say, right. It's fluid. And so in this fluidity that takes place, there's also the provider of the service, which is CCO, and they're on a capitated rate that's also a part of this redetermination process. How much volatility exists between the redetermination and the dollars that flow to CCOs?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, great question. We have been working to diminish volatility since the ACA stood up, and I think we're in a better position today than we were before. And particularly, we complete this last cleanup stack. I refer to them as kind of a cleanup stack. Once we get that done on August 31st, we continue our builds of our technology. We will continue our trend line of reduced volatility for those payments.
We've got two dates. May 31, can you explain what will be completed by May 31, and then what is to be completed by August 31?
Yes. Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, by May 31st, we will have caught up the backlog. There's been discussion, as you know, about there was a delay in processing applications, so we will have caught up the backlog. We will begin the detailed analysis of the 115,000 plus people of whom we think at least 72% are eligible, as we reflected in the forecast, the spring forecast. And that work will complete by August 31st this year. That's work that's already outlined, already planned, and will be executed by a public-private partnership of tasks.
Thank you. Right. I got my questions in.
Excellent. Senator Gelzer, did you help?
Okay. Representative Malmstrom.
Just maybe I'm over-clarifying this, but the audit alert claimed that OHA had failed to alert federal authorities. Is that true or not true? And second of all, is there any way that our prolonged process could jeopardize our federal funding?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, I've mentioned and we address in the slides that we have weekly conversations with CMS, and we will file quarterly financial reports with them. Excuse me. And I want to underscore that those conversations occur about all aspects of Oregon operations. So CMS, in our conversations most recently a week ago, considers Oregon an outstanding business partner. Second question was, is there any risk anywhere? And the response I would make to that is laws can change, policies can change. Part of the reason why we have been working so hard and managing aggressively is to be prepared for those changes, should they occur in the future.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, please, Senator Gilder.
I do have a question. On the timeline, and this kind of goes back to kind of this interaction with the audit, it says that you had a meeting to provide responses to the 9 questions posed by the Secretary of State, but the Secretary of State declined to come to that meeting with you to have those questions answered. Has that been resolved, and do you know why the Secretary of State did not come to get the answers to the questions that were posed to you?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, I obviously can't speak for the Secretary of State staff and why they were unable to join us that day. We had been meeting with them weekly on this matter up to that point. We've provided written responses to the question, and we are happy to meet with the Secretary of State on any day. I want to underscore that when I first met with the Secretary of State at the end of March, one of the things I outlined is that we have a number of audits in process every single day, and that we are pretty much an open book and want to provide all the information everyone needs. We have learned a lot about process improvement from people who are not directly working with us, and we're constantly listening and saying, how can we improve that? How can we correct that? We currently have 9 audits underway with the Secretary of State's office. We look forward to supporting those rigorously and with full disclosure and participation. We are available every day.
Actually, I had several questions. That was part of what I was kind of actually perplexed by, why the Secretary of State would decline meeting. And it looks like you had been meeting with them several weeks, and I assume this was about this redetermination process and the numbers.
Yes.
I'm saying April 6th, April 12th, April 19th, May 5th, and then
yes.
May 11th was the meeting that they canceled on you.
Yes, Chair Rayfield. And again, we're happy to provide information. Our staff is happy to provide information. We're happy to meet. One of the things that we are implementing through our Transformation Center, because of the challenges that Medicaid poses in terms of understanding its complexity and et cetera, is we're going to be our Medicaid team, our director, and physicians will be doing what we're calling Medicaid U to help everyone get on the same page about what this requires, what the federal standards are, what the logistics are, so that will be available to everyone, including the Secretary of State's office, to ensure that we're all starting from the same baseline of information, which will help us be efficient and effective in our in our business dealings.
And so just to get the timeline correct, you're having all of these meetings, and during these meetings, did you tell the Secretary of State that you're having weekly meetings with CMS? Did you tell them that you are that you had a verbal extension of the waiver to continue this process into March? I mean, did you update them that you have been telling the legislature this with that timeline that shows all of these meetings with the transparency with the legislative process? And did you convey to them that there's no exposure with regards to this prior to them issuing the audit alert to, like, the press?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, I did not attend directly those audit meetings. Those meetings were attended by our audit staff and our business IT lead, and perhaps our CFO may have been in several of those. If we didn't comprehensively answer those questions in those meetings, again, we are happy to do so now. I think we covered a lot of the details that you referenced, but they may have been much more detailed conversations than that high-level overview you've provided of key indicators.
Are the people that met with the Secretary of State here? I mean, what I'd like to know is whether that information was conveyed to the Secretary of State before he released an audit report to the press when he knew that it was a little bit misleading.
Chair Rayfield, Vivian, you were in the meetings. Please join us. Vivian is not from our audit team, so I just want to give her that. But she did attend because she's working in the operations side of the equation. Vivian?
Representative Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, yes, I did attend those meetings. At that time, those were really working sessions that the Secretary of State auditor staff attended with us so that we could review the data, start to understand the data that we were looking at, and start to get an overall grasp of what the work was that would be needed to resolve the remaining folks who were still within our legacy systems. There were a few questions that were posed to me directly in those conversations about what information had been shared with CMS and had been shared with others, and I just disclosed honestly in those meetings that I didn't have that information and that we could certainly provide that information, but I wouldn't be the appropriate person to provide it. So those were the only conversations that I was a party to where those questions were asked, and I said our Medicaid director and others could answer those questions.
Okay. Do you know if that follow-up ever occurred on behalf of the Secretary of State?
My understanding is that written questions were posed through email, and when we started answering those questions then were delivered to us in writing in a formal letter with a request for a written response. And I believe some of those written responses did address those questions directly. I do not know if there were other outside conversations.
So those written responses were given to the Secretary of State before the auditor's report was released?
That I am not sure of in terms of timeline.
Chair Rayfield, the responses to the Secretary of State, I believe it's Kim or Kyle?
Kim.
Kip McDermott were provided on May 11th. And I want to also underscore that we did not receive the alerts from the Secretary of State's office. We received them from people in this building after they were released to the media. And again, we are ready and able and happy to provide clarification on any issues. So
thank you very much, and I apologize.
And my question is a follow-up on that.
Okay, well, we'll do a follow-up on that, and then we'll get to Representative Smith and then Hayden.
So you answered half of the question that I had, which was between the time that the Secretary of State canceled the meeting on May 11th, at which you were going to answer the nine questions, which was a Thursday, and Tuesday when that embargoed alert was issued to the legislature, did the Secretary of State come and talk with you, give you a heads up, or a follow-up to ensure the accuracy of this alert that was going to be sent out to the press?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, no.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I actually want to ask the inverse of what Senator Gelsler just asked. Colleagues, on Friday, I was hyper critical of the Oregon Health Authority and its leadership based upon what I perceived as lack of information to the Republican caucus. And let me put some context with that. Each and every one of you on Ways and Means are doing your very best to help leadership, our co-chairs, the president, the speaker, balance the state's budget. And within our caucus, we've had conversations with Representative Hayden taking the lead and Leader McLean and myself talking about how are we going to manage a provider tax and to assist the Oregon Health Authority in providing health care to all Oregonians. And I don't think you'd find anyone at this dais or in this building, for that matter, who doesn't want to make sure that all folks have access to health care. And so I felt broadsided on Thursday evening when I read in the paper the issue before us, and at the same time, I'd been asked by multiple folks in this building to cast a vote for a provider tax. And so I'm trying to reconcile what's really going on here, and I'm trying to figure out, and again, I'm asking the inverse of Senator Gelsler's question, was there a reason why you didn't come visit with Leader McLean and myself and say, hey, you just need to know this issue's going on out here. Here's the facts. Here's how we're trying to manage this, rather than letting me read about it in the paper.
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, we read it in the paper when you read it in the paper. We submitted the questions response on May 11th as requested. It was, in our minds, we were responding to audit requested information. We were scheduled to do that. We did that. I did not know that it would become an issue, and I've said it before, and I'm happy to say it again. My accessibility to everyone in this building is 24/7. I've had a number of legislators from both parties call me over the weekend. I'm happy to give you my home and personal cell phone, but I read it in the paper when you read it in the paper, and have been compiling the information and being responsive, but never hesitate. I will reach out to you next time I read something in the paper that I think you'll be concerned about. I'm happy to pick up the phone and call you, and please do the same for me because I'm available all the time.
Mr. Co-Chair, you have been absolutely phenomenal in reaching out to me, and I appreciate it genuinely. This is going to sound very, well, let me measure my words here. I would just assume, after 9 terms in the legislature, knowing how large the Oregon Health Authority budget is and the role they play within our $78 billion budget, you would immediately would have got a hold of a handful of folks and said, can we share with you this is going on? I came into Ways and Means and had no idea this was going on. So maybe it's miscommunication. Maybe we can take this as a learning opportunity for both of us and figure out how to correct it. But it really set me back, especially as I'm trying to prep our caucus for how are we going to provide additional revenue to the Oregon Health Authority, and then I'm reading about this in the paper. So again, I admit I was hypercritical, but I think in some way I was justified in that.
Thank you, Representative Payne.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield. Just minor details. The Secretary of State's letter was dated May 4th with a requested response of May 9th. Rather than May 11th, and apparently the response did go out May 11th, which was 2 days after the requested response. I don't know if that plays into anything, but I'm reading the letter. So, point, just you can respond to that or not if you want to. My question really is two-part, and it comes back to your own analysis of the budget and the 28% that are ineligible. Math would tell us that's about 32,000 members. I don't know if those are fee-for-service or if those are in CCO, so there's no way I can put a dollar figure on that. I don't know what kind of dollar figure that is. But in your calculation for our budgeting forecast, is there a recoupment? I think what the question is I'm asking, is there a recoupment of that built in? And I don't think we're getting a clear answer. So you got 32,000 people that we know we're eligible, CMS approval to be eligible through the system that you've gone through, but will be determined to be ineligible for the next eligibility period. From 2016 or whenever, you know, is the forecast calculating a recoupment of whether those are fee-for-service dollars, whether those are CCO, capitated per member per month dollars? I don't know. I don't know who that population is. But it seems like there's about 30,000 members there that for whatever reason won't be eligible that were being paid for by your own report. So how does that calculate in?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. So first, to your first question, the May 9th versus May 11th, we informed the Secretary of State's office that we would be a couple days late. I will take responsibility for that in terms of I am really dedicated to accurate information. And so if we need to get a thorough and accurate presentation and it takes two more days, then we're going to respectfully request that. Secondly, with regard to recoupment is a word that, of course, concerns providers, concerns CCOs, concerns everyone. So what the health authority does consistently is constantly evaluate what the numbers look like they're going to be, and our forecast reflects our professional expertise on what the number will look like going forward, which includes this 115,000 plus and includes our estimate of where those people will fall. Now, as we've discussed today, that action plan will secure those numbers, and we will keep everyone apprised if there's going to be any huge variation or any significant variation. We aren't anticipating any. Remember that the process has been becoming less volatile, more clear, but what I want to assure you is that, and part of the challenge our professional people have is the numbers change every single day to get to closer and closer accuracy. And so do I project a recoupment at this time? I do not. But we monitor that possibility in all of our work on a weekly basis. Right.
So follow up, please. To make it, thank you, close to what I'm asking, so I'll be a little more direct. There's approximately 150,000 members on fee-for-service, which has grown since this process went in place, which that means that there are less members or caseloads in the CCOs. If a portion of these 32,000 members are from CCOs, are you saying on record that OHA, regardless of how federal government treats it, CMS treats it, are the CCOs going to be held harmless from a recoupment of their members, of whatever portion of these 32,000 members, if they're determined to be eligible? Will that ineligibility be calculated in a recruitment anywhere to the CCOs under the concern that there are already significantly more people on fee-for-service, which, you know, makes it difficult for those people to get access to care because the CCO network, I think, is arguably more robust than the fee-for-service network, and it makes it difficult for the CCOs to plan with that large of a fee-for-service, and then to have over their head this 30,000 members that might be recouped? Or are we saying that won't happen on a state level?
I'm going to ask Dr. Collins or Janelle. I don't know which of you would like to answer that. But
they all want to.
For the record, my name is John Collins. I'm the director of the Office of Health Analytics for the Oregon Health Authority. Chair Rayfield, Representative Hayden, basically the process that the Director Saxon has outlined for you is that all the activity that's going to occur for these 115,000, including that 30 or so thousand folks that you were mentioning, is going to be happening in the future. So if they're subsequently found to be ineligible for Medicaid through the normal processes that we're going through, that will kick into the MMIS system. If any of those people are members of the CCOs, they'll be disenrolled, obviously, from a CCO. So there wouldn't be any recoupment for.
There's no look back to 2016.
No.
Okay. And I want to add, for the last 3 years, Director Saxon, you have been very available by cell phone, text message, and emails, and I appreciate that. for me.
Senator Gelzer.
I just wanted to, we have the letter in the, it's not NOLIS, but it was sent to us last night. But one of the things that troubled me, that I was concerned about when I read the media reports, was this idea that the health authority had not been in communication with CMS. And I felt like it was important just to have on the record what the health authority said to the Secretary of State on May 11th. The question number six was, do you plan to inform CMS of this potential issue? If so, when? And the response from the health authority was, the agency has been in regular communication with CMS since 2013, when CMS approved Oregon's first waiver request, deferring dates for renewals scheduled for October 13 to March 2014. It goes on to say that CMS has worked closely with OHA and approved six waivers. It also goes on to talk about the monthly state operations and technical assistance calls, where the health authority has been keeping CMS updated. So I think the concern that I have is not that these aren't important issues that need to be addressed, but going back to Director Saxton's comment about, you know, maybe the letter was 2 days later than what was requested in order to have accurate information. I think the same can be true of an audit alert that is sent out about an audit that is not yet complete. I think that we can and should expect of our Secretary of State to send out information that is accurate, that is honest, and if it means delaying by an additional day or communicating directly with the agency director after canceling a meeting to get the answers, I expect more, because I can't begin to imagine the amount of work that this has caused by sending out an alert that clearly has some faulty and inaccurate information inside of it.
And just to add on to that, co-chairs, the full Ways and Means, and then myself and the good co-chair, Senator Hayward, who is actually away with her daughter's graduation, but she's watching live, so just know that she's with us. We all received initial receipts of the audit alert and went and met with the Secretary of State as well, with Ms. Ames, and then tried to facilitate, again, meetings, which we didn't know at the time that you were regularly meeting with the Secretary of State. But, I mean, I think that was before the May 9th meeting that was canceled by the Secretary of State. And then May 11th, the responses are then issued. And then on the 15th, the same audit report, which appears not to be edited after you've provided the Secretary of State with new information contradicting that, is then released to the press, which then I think the real, just to put a fine point on it, if we're going to do that, it has to be accurate information, because that can jeopardize the conversations we're having in this building, and that is a problem. So with that, are there...
Yes,
Senator Winters, please.
Chair, and this was a good forum. I want to say, of getting information on the record resulting from the audit alert and answering the questions of this body. I, as one who was working with you and others on the issue of the provider assessment to make certain that citizens in Oregon do receive health care, have access to health care. So I think the conversation has been robust. I personally want to thank the director and for here answering our questions, and for members of actually asking you some pointed questions. It's my hope that two things, that we continue to have transparency and open dialogue, because I think that's critically important. I would also, and I know 32 pages for an application is horrendous. Yeah. I don't know whether it was done as a discouragement for individuals to apply in the first place, but it's my hope that in consultation with CMS and others, that this get reduced down to a manageable form. I understand the complexity of doing the integration with DHS and the difference between that population and this one. But honestly, I hope as you go forward that you really would look. I think it would be two things. Not only time saving, but I do think it would help in the redetermination process.
Yes.
You know, when we're into information overload, you know, I often ask myself the questions, how much information that we ask other people that we really really don't need. So with that, that's all I have to say on this particular subject. I look forward to continue working, and as one who's working on the issue with my good young Gapper colleagues, we will get this done.
I appreciate the flattery, Senator Winters, unless you were talking about Representative Hayden, because he's also on the work group. But I think Representative has a couple questions to have you submit to the committee, yeah. But we do have to adjourn.
Very back up as hopefully committee questions, I would look forward to seeing a one-year budget.
Yep.
Since the August 31st date, yep. So we can have solid numbers to work with and be able to reconcile that. And then I would like more information on the eligibility process that doesn't require Social Security number. Right. If we could get some more information on how that works. Thank you.
Perfect.
Correct.
And with that, thank you very much for being here today. And also, thank you to Representative Nose and Representative Smith for making time for the committee as well. So, and with that, we'll go ahead and adjourn and see everybody Thursday.